This week's episode of Lucky Paper Radio is brought to you by Secret Lair, cards that do what they say they do. Are you tired of having to explain to new players that they're allowed to point their lightning bolt at your Jace, even though it doesn't say it can target planeswalkers? And then a few turns later, it's so awkward when they try and do the same thing with Flame Slash. What about a couple of years from now when the next generation of players has never even heard the phrase converted mana cost, now that the new term is mana value? Don't worry. Secret Lair, cards that do what they say they do, SLCTDWTSTD for short, is here to save the day. The latest drop contains 1,371 cards printed for the first time with updated, correct rules text, including all 691 cards affected by the Planeswalker Damage Redirection rules change, and every one of the 513 cards that reference converted mana cost. For just $7,834.99 for the regular edition, or $9,792.99 for the premium foil edition, you too can play with Magic cards that do what they say they do. TGIF, thank God it's Fibblethip. Welcome to Lucky Paper Radio. I'm your host, Andy, and I'm here with my co-host, Anthony, Island Identifier Maddox.
Oh, yeah. Man, that was one of my proudest moments in GeoGuessr. We were looking at this place. We have no idea where we are, but I know we're on an island for sure.
Did you see some sort of megafauna or something? Some sort of creature or plant that was island much bigger or smaller than it's supposed to be?
There was something about the use of sort of dilapidated resources and construction materials and the radio tower that really stuck out to me as this has got to be some isolated little island.
It was a tiny little island, and we did not succeed in finding the exact
I should say,
one.
did we correctly guess the island? No, we did not.
Well, of course not. Anthony is referencing GeoGuessr, which has taken over our friend group, Anthony, as a fun Corona-safe activity to do, just some remote GeoGuessr. This is a web-based game that has a lot of different game modes, but the primary way I've seen it played and the way we like to play is this open world game where you basically get dropped at a random spot, more or less random, on Google Earth Street View, and you are prompted to try and figure out by placing a pin on the map of the world where you think you are currently located. And it may sound pretty dumb and boring. At least if I heard that explained to me, I would think it wouldn't be that fun. But I got into this by watching some YouTubers that are particularly skilled and knowledgeable at GeoGuessr play. And for a while, I kind of put it off because I was like, I'm not smart enough for that game. I'm not going to be able to know what... I can't tell the difference between Turkish and some other language on a sign. I'm not going to be able to, like, figure this out. But I decided just to kind of play, and it's like everything that I think other people love about puzzles, I love about GeoGuessr, and I'm not a puzzle person.
What do people love about puzzles? And what do you mean when you say puzzles? Like jigsaw puzzles?
I mean puzzles more broadly, but jigsaw puzzles are certainly included in the set of things I'm talking about. A lot of, like, puzzly games, to me, just feel like I'm doing homework. It's just like, all right, well, the answer's here. I'm just supposed to fiddle around and try and figure it out, right?
Yeah, unlike Magic the Gathering, it's not a strategy game where you can, you know, like, synthesize and, like, evaluate risks and things like that. It's just like, can you find the pattern and do the work?
Right, exactly. And sometimes, there's a lot of puzzle games that are founded on some kind of, like, little trick that once you figure out the trick, you can just do it, and the whole game is just, can you figure out that
trick,
or do you already
know it? Rubik's Cube masters don't want you to know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the Rubik's Cube, for example, once you learn how to do it, it's just a matter of going through the process to do it. And I get why some people...
One day I'll figure it out myself.
I actually had a class in high school where we were forced to learn how to solve the Rubik's Cube.
Wow.
And so I learned it at one point. I no longer remember how to do it.
Quality
but I did
American
have to do it for
education.
An assignment. Well, yeah, this was in the gifted program, Anthony, so we did fun stuff like learn how to solve Rubik's Cubes as opposed to, you know, studying for our standardized test like everybody
That's
else.
That's extremely complicated.
Anyway, GeoGuessr is all of the best parts of what I think people like about those games for me, and there's a couple of very key components. One key component is that you can't figure out every single one of them. Nobody is smart enough to figure out any given clue. Some of them are just, here's a dirt road in the middle of some dirt, and this dirt could be pretty much anywhere, and the sun is, like, dead east in the sky, so you have no idea if you're in the northern or southern hemisphere. Like, sometimes there are just so few clues it's impossible to figure out. And so a lot of the fun is this one that we can actually solve if we work really hard to figure it out? And in my short tenure playing GeoGuessr, I've had a couple, probably like 5 or 6 that I've actually gotten a perfect score on, right? So I saw just a spot on Google Maps. I wasn't allowed to move, but I could pan and zoom around my little spot, and I found the exact coordinates on planet Earth within a few hundred meters, I think it's 150 meters to get a perfect score of where that pin was. And there's nothing more satisfying, where you're like in the French countryside and you turn around and you see one little road sign and you see an old building that you can see has the word inn on the sign, but you can't read the rest of the sign, so you know it's an inn in the French countryside, and it's between these two different towns based on some other signs you see. You try and figure it out, and it's just immensely satisfying.
Right. So sometimes you're just in a desert and you're like, well, we're in a desert that narrows it down to these 12 huge chunks of the world. There's a cactus, so we're pretty sure we're in North America. Let's just like drop a pin somewhere on this half of the continent and see where we end up. But sometimes it's like, yeah, you do see that sign and you're like, okay, well, we know the language. That narrows it down to a few countries. And then we know, like, we see a certain type of agriculture or a certain, like, shape of street signs. And yeah, when you get that first perfect guess, you, like, you literally find the intersection that the photo was taken. It's really, really satisfying.
It's the most satisfying thing. I remember that one we did where we found that exact on-ramp to a very small highway in, like, southern Turkey that we spent probably 20 minutes on. But we did finally eventually find the exact on-ramp with all those weird signs around that it was like in Turkey, but there was this Spanish-themed resort-ish kind of vacation destination that they had a sign for somewhat nearby, and it was very tricky to figure out. But yeah, once you figure it out and you're like, oh, I think it's this exact on-ramp, it's the best feeling in the world.
And that one really came down to just like, we are trying to figure out what is the shape of the highway that's coming down to an ocean or some kind of like large body of water. And narrowing it down to, like, imagine you're there. What do you think that this particular highway is going to look like? Also, I learned I don't know what the Turkish language looks like very well.
Yes, you and I definitely had a few moments where, like, no idea what this language is, but turned out it was Turkish, and we could not recognize it. It definitely, the game will make me feel like a stupid, untraveled Westerner pretty often, where I'm like,
oh, easily.
This
you're
is
like,
either.
Which particular part of Texas is this? And then it's like, oh, you're in New Zealand, my friend.
Or, you know, this is either, you know, South America or the Philippines. And it's like, and the fact that I can't figure out which
really
is
a tough one.
Is a big problem.
The vegetation looks so similar.
At least it does to my untrained eyes. Here's the other thing I love about that game. I think it's really fun that it's all real stuff. I feel like in a very tiny, completely meaningless way, I am learning a little bit about the world, you know?
That's so true. I mean, I was going to say, in so many ways, it does appeal to me for the same reasons that Magic appeals to me, because it's such, like, a huge game. Like, every round is a little bit different. Sometimes you're relying on sort of your understanding of, you know, whatever, rudimentary expectations about what vegetation looks like, or a little bit of language, or, you know, details like what side of the road you're on. So it's the synthesis of lots of different kinds of knowledge and really varied experience, all of which, you know, that appeals to me about Magic as well. The difference is I don't feel like, oh wow, I know all of this lore about the Phyrexians that's just taking up wasted space. Instead, it's like, okay, at least I know like what radio towers look like or whatever.
Right. You, for example, are the kind of person that knows there are no cactuses outside of North America, pretty much, which is not a thing I would have ever known, but you have some cactus knowledge.
Except Portugal is overrun with prickly pears, but they're not native.
Oh, it's an invasive cactus in Portugal?
I don't know if they're invasive or just very comfortable.
What's the difference, really, at the end of the day?
Perspective.
We have a lot in common, as I think listeners to this podcast will have picked up on by now. But one thing we don't necessarily share is you have an appreciation for fiction, and I really struggle with fiction, especially like books and movies and stuff, because I can't help but at some point, when I'm experiencing the fiction, reading or watching a thing, just in my head, there's this voice going, someone just made this all up. This is all just made up stuff. None of this is real. And that's part of what's frustrating me about regular puzzle games, where it's like, I'm trying to solve this dumb puzzle that somebody just freaking made up. Like, the fact that it was made up by some person that's ostensibly trying to trick me through space and time makes it much less satisfying. Where here, I feel like I feel like I've been given a totally unique opportunity to solve a puzzle in the world, right? Like, this was not constructed by somebody to trick me in a very specific sense. This was generated by some machine that was like, sure, here's a spot. Can you figure it out? And that's just, I mean, it's a subtle distinction, but it makes it so much more profoundly satisfying to me. I have no patience to sit down and do a like puzzle game. I'll get bored after 2 minutes, but I will spend 35 minutes looking up the coast of Spain because I'm 95% sure this highway is in Spain, and it seems like the East Coast for this reason, and I'm going to try and find this exact intersection, and it's just way more fun.
What you said just triggered in me like the most horrible feeling, like my stomach just dropped out of my abdomen.
Oh, great.
Which is that
I just thought,
how much better would I be at this game if instead you showed me any spot in Breath of the Wild or even Skyrim?
See, I would be very good at this game if you showed me a spot in Grand Theft Auto Vice City for the PlayStation 2. I played that game so much, I know the map of that game to the back of my hand. But yeah, I'd be much better at that than the real world for sure. We had an embarrassing moment where we saw a sign that said San Antonio, and we're like, all right, let's go find San Antonio. And we were looking and looking for San Antonio, we just couldn't find it because we were looking in California, where all the other sand cities are. And then about 90 seconds later, we're like, wait a minute, pretty sure it's San Antonio, Texas. Let's go down there and figure that out.
I mean, that wasn't the worst part about it.
That was not the worst part of that particular clue, because that location that contained the San Antonio Mexican restaurant was actually located in Washington State, which I don't think was particularly fair. But that did happen to us.
Please, if you are a restaurateur or other business owner, put the name of your town pretty prominently on the front of your business. It'll make everything a lot easier for everyone.
I love this meta idea. I'm just going to go around my neighborhood and just put up very specific signs that have cross streets and name of the city and stuff, just so anybody that finds it on GeoGuessr will have good luck in the future.
Are you more likely to do that or just sow chaos and just put like... What does Baltimore's climate and architecture look most like that is furthest from Baltimore?
Well, so my little tiny neighborhood I've always thought looks a little tiny bit like an English hamlet. Like if you just put up, you know, a couple of ye olde signs, I think you could convince somebody this is in like northern England.
Okay, just get a sheep. There's too many trees, though.
Well, we can cut them down. There you go. Too many trees is a solvable problem.
What, GeoGuessr? It's not GeoGuessr bombing, it's GeoGuessr... baiting, I guess.
I'm going to be haunted by the Iceland one we had. Was that just this morning or was that yesterday?
It all blurs together.
It does blur together. We've been playing a little bit in the mornings before work, which puts us under a time crunch, so you can't really get super deep on a clue and go hard on it for 30 minutes. And we had one where the image popped up and it was a beautiful countryside with mountains all around it and this like dark sandy dirt, and immediately we were all
really,
like, this
really
looks like Iceland
soil,
right? We all immediately were like, this looks like Iceland. None of us have been, to my knowledge, but I think we were like, this has to be Iceland. It just feels like all the Iceland marketing images we've seen. And we could see a sign for like a private property. It wasn't like a sign for a town, clearly. It was like a sign for some kind of resort or inn or some, like, you know, individual property that was readable. But the words didn't really seem Icelandic so much. We could see what we were pretty sure was a body of water to the south. And we were looking around Iceland for a while, and eventually we're like, we just got to move on because we don't have time to figure this one out. And sure enough, it was this little spot right on the Icelandic coast. And if you zoomed in on the map, you could in fact see the same words we saw on this sign. And I just was like, that was the perfect one. We could have gotten it exactly had we spent the 30 minutes. But
I mean,
instead,
or if we had spent a lot less time, if we had just stuck with our first impressions rather than someone shouting out last minute, well, this, you know, really could be, man, I wish my geography had actually gotten better.
I think we ended up dropping in the Faroe
Norway
Islands
as well. Yeah, so then you're like, well, let's split the difference. It could also just be this other island in here. Let's go for, you know, the risk averse plan. Didn't pay off.
But the joy for me really comes in getting it exactly. Sure, it's really cool to, like, you know, guess right and have the country right just by a vibe, but it's really that puzzle of, all right, here's where the road's bending, here's where the sun is, here's that mountain I can see in the distance, here's what I think is a body of water peeking through the hills, and trying to figure it out exactly. That's the fun for me. I don't get as much joy of like, yeah, this is probably Iceland, and then it was. Anthony, this is a magic podcast. We are 14 minutes into our magic podcast, and we've not once mentioned... I guess you did say something about the Phyrexians earlier, so that's going to count.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Write that down. I think we could tie this into magic a little bit. So one thing about this game that is interesting, which is a topic we talk about a lot, is that it does require you to make a good faith effort to have fun with it. Because you could so easily just, you know, start Googling things. Like, you see a street name, there's 11th Street and Davis Lane. Just Google that address. Which is interesting that, like, sort of like certain formats of Magic, you have to show up intending to have a good time and sort of follow the spirit of it and not just say, well, I'm just here to win and I'm going to spike it and do what's easiest for my win percentage.
What a great way to tie it all back into Magic, Anthony. A true wordsmith. I'm going to stick a couple of my favorite YouTube videos for GeoGuessr in the show notes. So if you are interested in seeing some high-level GeoGuessr, you can check that out there. We've talked about maybe streaming this a little bit, Anthony. And so if people are interested in watching Anthony and I badly play GeoGuessr and
joining along
in the Twitch chat, then, you know, let us know. Maybe we'll throw up a stream and just play some GeoGuessr, which is much easier to do remotely than play Cube, which is the actual subject of this podcast most of the time. We're doing a bit of a spring cleaning episode, which is why we allowed ourselves to go off the rails for 15 minutes and talk about GeoGuessr. So we're going to talk on a couple of vaguely related topics and just kind of meander along on this Friday evening episode of the show. But first, we're going to do our listener-submitted Pack 1 Pick 1. This week, the cube comes to us from listener Pablo. This is a medium-power cube aimed at new Magic players that minimizes individual card complexity while trying to maximize depth. And I can see from the description of the cube that it excludes any non-evergreen mechanics except for cycling, flashback, and kicker, which, if you had to tell me what three mechanics would I want to be evergreen that are not currently evergreen, I'm pretty sure my shortlist would be cycling, flashback, and kicker. Those are basically my favorite mechanics in Magic, so this cube is already tugging my heartstrings a little bit.
Give it a year or two. I think at least cycling is going to get in there.
Prowess is up there too for me. That was once evergreen and is not technically anymore. I really like that ability as well. I will read the pack, and then we will cut to Anthony, who will tell us what cards he's looking at for his pack one, pick one. The pack is Stomping Ground, Seasoned Hallowblade, Leonin Warleader, Pelt Collector, Thriving Bluff, Blade Splicer, Wilt, Soul Herder, Silent Clearing, Soul Manipulation, Reassembling Skeleton, Perilous Mirror, Lingering Souls, Kitesail Freebooter, and Conclave Mentor. What are you looking at, Anthony?
I love so many of these cards.
That's not what I asked. I said, what are you looking at?
I think what the safe pick here is Thriving Bluff. And we've talked about this a little bit, how I sort of had this realization as soon as they printed Shimmerdrift Veil, which is the sort of like Evolving Wilds variant. It enters the battlefield, you choose a color, and then it taps for that color. That as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh wait, the Thriving Bluff cards are all just that with bonus. So it doesn't have to be a red X card. It's just an any color card that if I happen to be playing red also is a dual land, so it's even better. So
right.
I think I want to
jam Thriving Bluff in your blue-white deck because it's either a blue or a white source, so the fact
exactly,
that it's never
yeah.
both is fine.
And this looks like it's a little bit of a slower format. I'm going to be happy with the tap land, but still definitely want fixing. So I think that's the safe and correct pick. Soul Herder also really stands out as probably the most powerful card here with the biggest upside. And then I also really like Leonin Warleader. I know that's probably the wrong choice, but as a person who loves to play Hero of Bladehold and hope my opponent doesn't have removal, it really tugs at my heartstrings.
I don't think it's a wrong choice at all. No. I will push back a little bit on the what makes you, from looking at this pack, say that this cube seems a little slow? Because I'm looking at this pack and I see exactly one card over 3 CMC and lots of efficient, aggressively costed creatures. Why do you assume this is going to be a slower environment?
Just in terms of the power level. I mean, when I say slower, I definitely don't mean super slow. I just mean compared to like your Legacy cube or something like that. Which at that point, I feel like then, like, the tempo of having a tap land really does start to tax your mana base.
Well, it's funny. I'm not actually sure that the, like, speed of an aggro deck necessarily has to fall off when you decrease in power level by very much at all. Like, I think of all of the kinds of decks that aggro probably suffers the least once you start excluding non-evergreen mechanics or you start excluding super complicated cards because, I mean, aggro, all it really needs is a bunch of, you know, one mana 2/1s or, you know, it's really cheap interaction and stuff, which is not necessarily complicated. So I would say this list, if anything, looks a little bit fast to me from this pack, just from looking at Seasoned Hallowblade, Kitesail Freebooter, Conclave Mentor, Lingering Souls, Perilous Mirror, Blade Splicer, Pelt Collector. Those are all very efficient bodies.
Yeah, that's fair.
So the first card that jumps out to me from this pack is just Blade Splicer in terms of raw power level. I think it and Leonin Warleader are actually kind of close, and because Blade Splicer is a single white, I would probably lean on Blade Splicer over the War Leader, but I could totally see an argument for War Leader too. It's just it's a good threat that I'm happy to put in pretty much any deck, really. I mean, I guess not really a super dedicated control deck, but I'll play Blade Splicer in aggro. I'll very happily play it in mid-range. Something like Leonin War Leader, I'm not as excited to play in an aggro deck, and conversely, something like Seasoned Hallowblade, I'm not really excited to play in a mid-range deck, so while those two cards, I think, are better in their respective shells, Blade Splicer, I think, splits the difference in being very, very good in both without making me commit off the bat. I wouldn't start on the tap land, but I think Silent Clearing is a reasonable contender here as well. A hybrid land, we've talked about how the Horizon Cycle of lands, the ones that can tap for one of two colors of mana while dealing damage to you, or you know, pay one and tap and sacrifice it to draw a card. Those lands, you don't have to be in black-white to play Silent Clearing, right?
Right, yeah.
You can be in any black or white deck and happily play that card. So that, to me, feels pretty open. And if it ends up being a faster environment, certainly a card I'd much rather have than a thriving land.
This cube looks great.
I really like this cube, too. Just from my brief glance at it, it's kind of right down my alley. So great job, Pablo. I think this cube looks very sick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be very defensible also to take Freebooter, or like even Perilous Myrrh is a card that is obviously a very open pick and just continues to impress me in my own cube. This is probably a little bit higher power than my cube, but still it seems reasonable.
Yeah, I wouldn't be first picking it, but I agree that Perilous Myrrh always does more than I expect it to. It's one of the most annoying cards to play against if you are an aggro deck, because it's two colorless mana, and all of a sudden you're like, I'm going to get 2-for-1'd by this stupid 2-mana 1-1, because it's going to block something with 1 toughness, and then it's going to kill something else. And or in a pinch, just 1-for-1 trades with something with 3 toughness for right, 2 colorless yeah. mana is a really decent rate.
It's like everything that I want out of an artifact creature. It's flexible, it fits in a lot of spaces, it's not super exciting, but it sort of plays this like filler role in a really, really good way.
So yeah, I think it's going to be Blade Splicer for me, though. Shoutouts to all the cards we talked about. And I'll also say that Lingering Souls is just a card that I'm always impressed with.
Absolutely.
But I would hope to pick up a little bit later. If this pack was looking slow to me, I'd be more inclined to say Soul Herder. But frankly, it's not. This list seems pretty tight, and there's not a lot of fat on it. And so I don't really expect, just from my very brief glancing at this, I'm not going to come out of the gate and expect to try and draft a greedy deck. I'm going to try and draft a nice, clean, good mana, two-color deck maybe even a one-color deck, and just beat my opponent down. So I think I'm going to start on Blade Splicer after all is said and done.
Or, you know, why not just Pelt Collector?
The true answer to why not is because I have basically no experience playing green aggro, and so, A, I don't know how good of a card Pelt Collector is in that deck. I expect very good. It's probably the best green aggro card or among them. And B, I wouldn't know what else necessarily to look for. I feel less confident in my ability to draft that deck successfully.
I would have a lot of fun drafting, you know, Pelt Collector, Champion of Lampholt, and Wildwood Scourge. Like, this 1-1 counters, sort of aggressive deck, but really based around the synergy of these 1-1 counters is definitely up my alley.
I think if you take that Pelt Collector, you have a pretty darn good chance of wheeling that Conclave Mentor and just
strongly
popping
agree.
Off, as
yeah.
they say.
Yeah, I think it's almost easier in this pack. Like, I like that there are all these different cards that are leading us in different directions. We're not just sort of paralyzed with the decisions. At the same time, almost anything here is a defensible pick. I think the only things I would really sort of look sideways at are Conclave Mentor being, like, a very high synergy pick. You really need to be in that spot. And same with Reassembling Skeleton. I think those are the two things that kind of fall off the bottom to me. And potentially
yeah,
will,
but
just
similarly,
for being a
like
sideboard card.
I like some density of those kinds of cards in a cube.
Oh, absolutely. Like, those are really going to pay off if you're in that right spot for them.
You could say the same thing of Soul Herder, though maybe a little more generically flexible in the way it can be built around than something like Mentor or Reassembling Skeleton. I personally, as much as I love flexible, good cards that just do their thing pretty much all the time, I do think that it can be pretty flattening to the draft experience of a cube if all of the cards fit that definition, and you don't have
totally,
any card
yeah.
that really prompts you to dramatically adjust your prioritization of other cards in the pack to draft around it in some way. So I'm excited to see something like Conclave Mentor here and Soul Herder, because that gives me a direction. And maybe more importantly, I think it's great to have options for your drafters. Some players are going to want to cobble together their deck of good stuff however they want, and some players are going to want a more clear, here's my signpost, I want to do something that this, I want to make this card good, right? And if there's something for those players, then they might not have as much fun drafting your cube, frankly.
Yeah.
So what are you taking at the end of the day? Is it Pelt Collector? Wait, you confused me. What are you taking?
I've confused myself. I think
Thriving
that
Bluff still?
Thriving Bluff is still, it's just the safest pick.
Usually I'm the coward, but you can be the coward today. Anthony's on Thriving Bluff. I'm on Blade Splicer. If you want to be like Pablo and have your cube praised and drafted on Lucky Paper Radio, you can mail it to mail@luckypaper.co along with your name and pronouns, and we will do a pack one, pick one on the air at some point in the future.
Praise is not guaranteed.
Anthony, I owe you an apology, I feel like.
Really? For what?
Well, I mean, you were laughing at me quite a bit and egging me on, but I did pop off a little bit on a rant when we played our match from the rotisserie, the aforementioned rotisserie draft of your regular
cube.
Oh, sure,
you did have some words, yeah.
I did say multiple times how much I hated my f***ing deck. I hate my f***ing deck. It's so
right.
Awful.
Well, I think I appreciate your apology, but I didn't feel like that was a criticism of me or the cube that I had designed. I felt like your mistake was entirely your own, and you would come around to realize it.
Great. I am glad. Now that I've realized my mistake, can you explain it back to me? Because, you know, I've played all but one of my rotisserie matches. One of our players has been a little bit hard to get in touch with, but I am thus far 2-4, and the games I've lost have felt terrible, and the games I've won have not felt that much better. And after this last game, where I did pop off a little bit and kind of carried on about how much I hated my stupid deck, it's a stupid f***ing dumb f***ing deck, you and another drafter in our group said, like, yeah, well, we knew your deck was bad. And I would love for you to explain why, because I still don't fully get it.
Why what? Why I specifically had that reaction? Or, like, I guess part of the question you're asking is, like, what is this deck supposed to look like in this environment? And my question was, what is this deck?
Do you think it's that far afield that you don't even understand what I'm trying to accomplish?
Tell me
with
what
my
you're
deck?
Trying to accomplish. Give me the elevator pitch.
All right. So people can go look at this deck and all the other rotisserie draft decks. And if you want, listen to the episode where we talked about this draft in a little more detail. I will link all this in the show notes, but the full picks are available for you. I am column one on this rotisserie draft sheet, so I pack one, pick one booster tutor, then some triomes, and then some other stuff, and basically ended up in primarily black-green, kind of splashing blue. Blue ended up being split among a number of drafters, but regardless of that, I still got some blue cards that I thought were worth playing, and my fixing was very good, so I did play them anyway. Anthony, here is my plan. I
booster tutor.
I wouldn't call this a control deck, strictly speaking, because I don't think it has some of the landmarks of, like, classic capital C control. But what I was going for is I expect games in your cube to be decided by synergies and card value for the most part. So I drafted with a perspective of I want to pick up a lot of two-for-ones. I want to pick up things that will give me card advantage in the long game so I can win long games. I want to pick up little interactions that, if uninterrupted, will generate me a bunch of value. One example of this is I got both Murderous Redcap and Soul Diviner. Murderous Redcap being a persist creature that deals damage to stuff when it enters the battlefield, and Soul Diviner being that blue-black 2/3 from War of the Spark that lets you tap it to take a counter off a permanent you control and draw a card. So my little engine there is that if both those are in play and the Soul Diviner does not eat a removal spell, then I can continually chump block things with my Murderous Redcap or attack if that is the flavor of the day, and it basically never dies because I can keep taking that counter off of it and generate more card advantage and draw cards. So I took a bunch of these value-generating cards. You know, I took a thing like the Eldest Reborn, which is a 3-for-1, right? It's a little slow, but it's a 3-for-1 under almost all circumstances, and I was thinking about this card advantage axis. I ended up with a couple of board wipey things. So I have Find Finality, which is the split card in Golgari, which is mostly being played for the finality side, which is 4 black-green to put 2+1/+1 counters on a creature you control and then give all creatures -4/-4 till end of turn, which under most circumstances is a board wipe that lets you have one of your big creatures survive, which is pretty cool. I ended up with Drown in Sorrow, which has been all right in my games. That's a black sorcery that gives all creatures -2/-2 till end of turn, and you get a scry one. So I took some of those cards because I didn't want to lose to the occasional speedy draw from an aggro deck, which is possible in your environment. I also took a bunch of cheap creatures, so I have cheap 1/3s and 2/3s and stuff just to kind of block and trade off. And I took removal pretty highly. I have quite a few removal spells, a couple counter spells, and my goal was basically to kind of control the game, generate a bunch of card advantage with these engines and just raw 2-for-1s and 3-for-1s that I drafted, and then finish the game with a big Archfiend of Ifnir, with hard casting things like Crozen Tusker and Greater Sandworm, with generating a bunch of value with Squirrel Nest or a Sylvan Advocate that becomes a 4-5 with Vigilance, or even beating down with Manlands was one of the things I was considering doing. I have quite a few Manlands in my deck too, so that's what I was going for. My deck, as I mentioned on the last podcast where we talked about it, was very modal. My goal was to always be able to do something relevant with my cards and not ever be stuck with something dead in my hand. So I've got a lot of cycling. I've got cards I can use in different ways, which I thought was valuable. And the way these games have played out, this deck has just not worked at all. The games where I felt like I was succeeding at my plan, where I had my opponent under enough control that I wasn't threatened in the near term and the game was going to the late game, I wasn't winning in the late game because I didn't have some very specific, like, deck-wide synergy. Like, I wasn't the artifact deck. I wasn't the heroic combat trick deck. I wasn't the blink deck. I was just the Sultai value deck, which couldn't keep up with those engines in the late game.
Right. I think that's the issue I see, is you're just spread out a little bit too thin. So you don't necessarily have an extremely proactive strategy, but a lot of your reactive options are a little bit conditional and spread out in different kinds of effects, such that if you just don't draw the right one, if you don't draw the Drown in Sorrow at the right turn, you're kind of out of luck. So I do...
Counterpoint, I very often do draw the Drown in Sorrow on the perfect turn, and it turns out I'm still out of luck.
Still not enough?
I have turned that into a 3-for-1 in multiple games that I have then gone on to lose.
So, I mean, if I look at just a subset of the cards, like Courser of Crucifix and Eldest Reborn and Crozen Tusker, like, these things start to form a plan, but I think you just need a little bit more to beef that up and just, like, add to the board and be proactive. Especially because when we look at, like, these decks look very different than the decks we usually see drafted in this cube, where they're extremely proactive, extremely focused on a plan for the most part. And I think, yeah, you're just vulnerable to having a bad draw. I also think you're not benefiting from splashing. You spent a bunch of early turns taking lands, but I don't think splashing for blue is adding that much value. And similarly, like, the things that you have that are kind of proactive, including that kind of, like, synergy you mentioned between Murderous Redcap and Soul Diviner, I don't think either of those cards have a high enough floor in your deck specifically to really merit that. I mean, it's hard to really be that mean to a Murderous Redcap, but I think those just work so much better when you have the opportunity for those to interact with, you know, 3 or 4 different cards in your deck. And then if you're just playing, like, well, I'm playing blue-black, I have a pretty focused plan, and a 2-3 on turn 2 is pretty good. Here it's like, well, if I get my 2-3 on turn 8, and I also have this other card, now it starts to add up to something.
I mean, again, just the counterpoint, my games have gone very long, and in multiple games, I have assembled this engine. I actually don't think I've ever cast Soul Diviner without Murderous Redcap right there to start assembling this value. And it just never works. My opponent just always takes apart my engine because they had a removal spell, or it doesn't matter. They have me dead on board, and who cares that I can draw a card every turn and chump block indefinitely? It's completely irrelevant. Here's what I've felt.
I guess that's a counterpoint against Puppet Conjurer as well, huh? I hadn't thought about that.
Buddy, we don't have to go down the Puppet Conjurer road again. Here's what I felt. I have felt that I misevaluated a lot of individual card power level in this environment. For example, I took the Eldest Reborn very highly. I took it my 5th pick because I felt it was very easy to splash no matter what color deck I was playing, because it's only 1 pip and it's at 5 CMC, so I can just play that. This is the 5-mana saga that the first chapter is your opponent sacrifices a creature, the second chapter is you discard a card, and the third chapter is you can reanimate something from any graveyard, a creature or planeswalker, and put it into play under your control. So it is almost always a 3-for-1, albeit kind of slow. And this card has been dead awful in all of my games, and I have sided it out in every single match because all of my opponents are either playing a series of little dinky creatures that come together to form a synergy, or they're making a bunch of tokens. Even, like, the blue-red Spellslinger deck, which has almost no creatures in the list, like, there are very, very few creatures in the list, the creatures are Murray Mystic and Young Pyromancer and stuff that just make a bunch of tokens. And so, unless I time it exactly right, I'm never going to get the thing that matters with my Eldest Reborn. And that's just a card that I have felt has been very good in your cube in the drafts that I have played it, in the regular drafts, and here it's been dead awful, and I'm just not playing my 5th pick in games 2 and or 3 because it's just been terrible. Similarly, I think that almost all of my removal has been terrible. And here's my argument for this. I know that your perspective on your cube is that you don't want to run the super efficient removal because you want more committal creatures to be viable. You don't want someone to play an Archfiend of Ifnir and just get it immediately, you know, chewed up by a one or two mana removal spell reliably, because that makes something like Archfiend of Ifnir not ideal anymore. You don't want to do that. It's not an optimal strategy. So your removal starts at 3, and you have a lot at 3 and 4, and kind of in that sort of CMC range. The removal I ended up with, just my removal suite so we can go over it, if we count Discovery Dispersal, I have Discovery Dispersal, I have Eldest Reborn, Find Finality, Archfiend of Ifnir, Murderous Redcap, Ulcerate, Drown in Sorrow, Deadweight, I won't count the counter spells, Murder, Status Statue, and I've occasionally sided in Collision Colossus. And all of these spells have felt bad because all of my opponents, the things I care about removing, have been cheaper than my removal spells, which has felt terrible. Or, in the case of like our matchup, me removing your Traxos, which is the card that mattered the most in our matchup, in both of our games, I removed Traxos 2 to 4 times, and you just continued to get it back. And you had all of these cards in your deck that were designed to rebuy artifacts out of your graveyard, which is what your deck was designed to do, and I felt like every time I used a removal spell, it was making your deck better because I was turning on these recursion cards in your hand, but I had no option but to do that, and all your recursion cards are much cheaper than my, I spend 4 mana to status your Traxos, and you cast Macabre Waltz and get it back for 2 mana, and I spend 3 mana to murder it, and you play Mirror Retriever and then sacrifice it to Sigh, and you draw some cards, and for only 2 mana get it back again, and it just, all the removal has felt really bad, and so I feel like what I'm learning out of this environment is that I should not be prioritizing removal. I should just be prioritizing my linear synergistic strategy and trying to make it better than my opponents, because those are the decks that are running over me, the decks that barely care about what I'm doing and are just doing their strategy as big and as consistently as they can.
I totally agree with, you know, your impression about the removal is something I've observed as well. I think I'm really curious how much of that is different because of the rotisserie draft. And like you said, everybody's decks are much lower to the ground than we've seen in a normal draft. And again, this is a larger than 360 cube. So these decks are just like better, even like taking out all the other complications of how a normal draft works. These decks are just going to be a little bit more powerful.
Because we just didn't draft the 100 cards that we thought were the worst or the least appealing for our decks. Whereas when you sit down to draft at a table with 8 people, you're taking a random selection 360, which will include presumably a big chunk of those cards.
Right. And a lot of people are just able to jump into those really synergistic strategies, which might be much riskier to go into in a normal draft as well. So, you know, you mentioned Young Pyromancer and the Oketra's Monument combo, these kinds of effects that I agree the removal has felt a lot worse. I don't feel like, I wouldn't characterize it as being bad or unnecessary. Like, I feel like I do still need that one removal spell to kill the Murmuring Mystic to actually stay in the game. But I'm curious, yeah, both how much that is just a difference between rotisserie draft versus a booster draft, and also how much maybe this just is giving people a different perspective on this particular environment, and I'm curious if that difference will carry over into the next draft.
Yeah, I'm really curious to know what happens when we do the next regular draft with the same group of people, because my perspective on the environment has changed a lot over this experience, and just getting trounced repeatedly by basically everybody in the pod, which has been a feel bad. I guess what it comes down to is, like, if you look at my removal, I either have things that can't remove Murmuring Mystic, like Ulcerate, Drown in Sorrow, Deadweight, Eldest Reborn, can't remove it, Murderous Redcap. None of those things actually deal with Murmuring Mystic. Or I have Murder, Status Statue, and I guess Dispersal, kind of, which do deal with it, but what I'm doing is I'm playing an expensive removal spell for the hopes that I get to trade even on mana with my opponent for the really important threat at the right moment, right? They play their Murmuring Mystic on curve. I have the removal spell immediately before they make a bunch of birds. Then it's an okay trade. Then I'm like even, right? And for that cost, I'm playing a 4-mana removal spell on my deck that in most of my games is just either rotted in my hand or I had to use it on something much more mana efficient and cheaper because I was just going to die to some little dinky creature and the only removal I had was this 4-mana statue or something. And I think that cost is very significant. I think one thing that people don't often talk about is the cost of playing a reactive deck, right? If you're playing a proactive deck, you just want to curve out, right? You want to play your proactive cards, whatever they may be, as quickly as possible. And what your opponent is doing is not as relevant to the relevance of your cards, right? Like, you can goldfish a proactive aggro deck and kind of figure out, like, yeah, you know, by turn 3 or 4, I can do roughly this much damage. Just simply have one removal spell or one blocker. Can I clear it? Can I not? Whereas if you're playing a deck full of counterspells and removal spells, your cards don't work unless your opponent does certain things. And having these expensive and conditional removal spells has mostly been a liability for me in these matchups. And again, this could be the nuance of the specific rotisserie draft. It might not carry over to regular drafts, but that is definitely how I felt. I felt like I overvalued removal, and that was one of my biggest mistakes. So I took removal fairly highly, used a lot of picks on it, and it's all been pretty awful for me.
It's really interesting, because I almost feel the opposite, where not only do I wish I had a little bit more removal, I don't know if I'd be main decking all of it, or more than I have now, but I wish I had more, and I especially really wish I had more cheap removal, like Ulcerate and Deadweight, and Bloodchief's Thirst was one I really regret not picking up when I took something else. But I wonder if that is because, like, my deck is leading towards a specific game plan, and I just want to make sure that on turn 6, you know, I can double spell with Traxos and another cheap artifact or something like that, and I just don't want to get run over by a Fearless Fledgling before I can get to that point.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I have not had very many opportunities where it felt like the cheap removal was really doing anything for my deck, but our strategies are very different, so I could be wrong there. The last card I have not at all been impressed by, and I hate to say it because I know you love this card, but Croce and Tusker has felt terrible, I gotta say.
Interesting.
You know, In theory, I like it because it's a modal card, right? And right. I think for all intents and purposes, in your environment, and probably in most environments, the primary mode of Croce and Tusker is the cycling mode. So it's basically a three-mana divination where one of the cards is a basic
hand. I think on Cube Cobra, it's listed as a three-mana instant.
Sure. And I've cast it for that sometimes, and that's been fine, but I would not play that card if it just had that side. Like, to me, the value is that you do sometimes have this 7-mana threat, and the 7-mana threat has been so far from relevant, it's not even funny. Like, the number of creatures my opponent has to chump block it, to completely ignore it, like, I have cast it as a threat on 7-mana a couple times because I drew it and had 7-mana, and every time I'm like, you know what, I probably should have just cycled this because maybe I would have drawn something better, even though I actually have a 7-mana to play this 6-5 out. It's just been completely irrelevant on board in all of my games, which makes me much lower on the card than I initially was.
That is tough to hear. I mean, you can chide Puppet Conjurer all you want. I understand why it's there, and it's not there for most people. Croce and Tusker, on the other hand, is a card that's sort of like a benchmark card for the kind of interactions and the kind of power level I'm going for. I definitely agree. It's not in the top third or even top half of the power level of the cards. But if it's totally irrelevant, that would be disappointing. I'll put a little flag on it.
Could again be a quirk of the rotisserie draft where these decks are not representative of normal draft decks, but that is certainly how it is felt. And then even against you, Anthony, against your artifact deck, your deck is all artifacts, and I brought in out of the sideboard Reclamation Sage and Thrashing Brontodon, which are two cards that are ostensibly supposed to hate all over your deck, and it was just more removal for me to fuel your more recursion spells, and I still eventually died to stupid Traxos. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like, I don't understand how I'm supposed to win most of these matchups, honestly, in the colors I'm in. And maybe that's just my fault for prioritizing these cards and, you know, going for the open color. But the one thing I did notice is that, you know, we talked during the draft. I actually felt like people were undervaluing green. I thought the green cards were good and no one was taking them, so I ended up being the primary green drafter. Having now played with the cards, what I do think is missing from green in your cube, maybe, hypothesis, is some strong synergistic payoff for being in green. It's not that the individual cards are worse than the cards in other colors, but when I look at blue-red, you have the spell-slinging deck. When I look at combinations of Esper, you have these blink synergies and like the recursive stuff. When you look at red-white, you have the heroic and the combat trick kind of thing with Feather going on. Blue-black has the Artifact Matters deck that can kind of spread into some other colors. I don't really understand what green's big synergistic payoff is meant to be. There's like occasional landfall things, but there's not really enablers for the landfall deck, aside from the Prismatic Vistas everyone wants anyway. And it just feels like there's not really a way to take the green cards and combine them so that they are worth much more than the sum of their parts, which is what a lot of the other powerful decks seem to be wanting to do.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially in the context we've been talking about the rotisserie draft being much more synergy-based. Because there was sort of a dissonance to me where green has historically been, like, the problem color. It's sort of the deck to beat in most drafts that we've done of this cube. So that does kind of make sense, and I'm going to think about that.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I will say, to your credit, you know, we've talked before on this show about your relationship to the greedy 4 or 5 color, just take expensive cards, good stuff deck that was often base green, because green does have some access to mana fixing in the form of stuff like Croson Tusker. And being the drafter that took fixing the most aggressively, I got 2/3 of the way through a Sortisserie draft, and I was like, even though I can splash for any of these cards really in this cube, I don't want to, which I think...
Which again, might also be a feature of the Rotisserie Draft, because those premier cards that people know are splashable are going to go higher, whereas you can open them up in Pack 2 or Pack 3 in the Booster Draft.
That's totally true, because, you know, if I had opened a Kess or, you know, something like that, I certainly would have just splashed it happily, but I didn't, because all those high synergy build-arounds were taken aggressively, which is maybe just a factor of the draft I didn't think about. Maybe in my seat in a Rotisserie Draft, I shouldn't have been planning to be the greedier multicolored deck that would soak up all the leftover good stuff, because there was no good stuff left to soak up. But I also think it's a sign that there are, I think, fewer like freebies for that deck, which I think is one of the most important ways to curb the power level of that deck. You hear cube designers talking all the time about cutting down on their fixing or something to try and make that deck worse, and I really think the most compelling thing to do is just make sure that if someone takes a bunch of fixing greedily and has no real cohesive strategy other than play good cards, don't give them any good cards that, you know, work in that deck. Like, make sure that those, those powerful cards are build arounds.
Making sure that synergies and aggressive strategies are sort of keeping that in check.
Anyway, I just wanted to put a bow on that a little bit and say sorry for all the horrible things I said about my deck I drafted. I will say this is not an excuse, but I do definitely... I get a lot more salty playing remotely digitally than I do in paper because, you know, the physical experience of playing on a computer sucks. It's awful. And so as a baseline, I'm just a little less happy than I normally am. And
really?
Yeah, having
2021, you're less happy than you wish you were. Weird.
You know, just a little bit, just a little bit. So that was definitely a contributing factor too. And if you hadn't been laughing so hysterically at me, I probably wouldn't have carried on as much as I did. But I'm glad that you saw that it's just me being mad at myself for making a horrible mistake and not a reflection on the environment.
I will say, just like to cap this off, well, maybe even before we cap this off, can we talk really briefly about Mortarpod?
Yes, we can.
Mortarpod has crushed me and everyone else. I guess more broadly, it was really exciting to see a lot of cards that I almost never see end up in people's decks. People took pretty early and played them, and they are not traps, and they are working very well. That's been one of the most satisfying aspects of this whole draft experience. And Mortarpod is really among them, where I'm like, I like this card, it sort of fits a specific role, but it's kind of marginal, and to see it just, like, take over games is a lot of fun.
I do think that reach is valuable in this environment.
Definitely.
Most of the games I thought that reach is valuable, and even though Mortarpod is kind of below rate for reach in an abstract sense, it is a very low cost of inclusion. Like, the card does something in pretty much any deck on pretty much any board. It's never like totally dead. It's also a cheap card. It does trigger your artifact matter synergies and stuff, and the fact that it then can be converted into a inevitability engine, I do think gives it, I think it makes it very playable here, and I agree. I was impressed by it when I lost to it. Every player has lost to the player with Mortarpod. I don't know how much Mortarpod has been responsible for it, but while we're doing a little recap here, are you concerned about the player that is 6-0, only losing a single game, and still has that one match left to play against our ghost drafter? Or do you think that outcome is well within the range of acceptable outcomes for you?
I mean, it's a little bit extreme, but are you surprised by it?
A little bit, honestly. I'm a little surprised that this person has dropped a single game out of 13. That is, I mean, going 6-0 is one thing, but only losing a single game is pretty dramatic, I would say.
I mean, can you say? Mortarpod's pretty good.
And here's the thing. I will suggest that I think our listeners, by looking... Oh, we just said it's the Mortarpod drafter. Damn, I was going to say we could have them look at the list, and they know my deck and they know your deck, but of the 6 remaining decks, I wonder if people would be able to guess which deck was currently 6-0. I think people would
Here's
not be able
do.
To figure
it out. If you're
a
listener, which chances are you are...
hey, if you're listening to this, guess what? You're a listener. That's a rule, baby.
We can do logic. Show one of your friends who plays Magic and get them to evaluate what they think is the records for each deck. And then also tell them to listen to the podcast.
I did this once on Reddit with a normal draft of my own cube. I posted all the lists and just said, hey, fun
that's
game.
That's a good idea.
Fun game. Just everybody, you know, guess what you think the records are of this pod. And whoever gets closest or gets it right, I'll like send you some cards in the mail. And I got like a few dozen guesses. And nobody was super close, honestly. And importantly, in that particular draft, there was a Esper control deck that O3'd. It was the O3 deck, and tons of players thought it was either 3-0 or 2-1. Most of the people guessing thought that that was one of the best decks, and it turned out to have O3'd in the draft itself, which, I mean, speaks to both just variance, like a deck can look very good, but on play out not so great, but also I think it speaks to just, I think some people over-evaluate specific cards, and they see a deck that has Snapcaster Mage and Jason, and they're like, this deck's full of great cards, it must be really good, but actually I think that deck was missing some core structural pieces that didn't make it come together completely.
It's hard to see what's not there.
Right, exactly. It's hard to see what's not there and see the whole picture, and people just saw really good blue cards and were like, this must be a great deck, and it actually was missing some pieces. So maybe, you know, I'll post this on the Reddit absent the podcast. So if you're listening to this, don't comment on the Reddit and say which deck 6-0'd, but we'll post it there and see if people can guess. I'm curious to know.
So how I would cap it off is to say, you know, again, when we went into this, I was a little bit apprehensive because Rotisserie Draft especially is so often presented as like an exciting opportunity to play the most powerful cards in Magic history and like be first picking a Black Lotus every time. And this is not that, but it was very much a different thing. Drafting this lower power, more synergy driven cube actually had a ton of dynamic picks that lasted much, much later in the draft than I expected, where people were still fighting over these sort of like overlapping effects. So I would say do a Rotisserie Draft.
Yeah, we said that last time, but I will reiterate it. It's been so fun. You made that great template. Highly recommend Rotisserie Drafting your cube with your friends, be they local or remote. All right, real quick, while I'm owning up to stuff, I also got to come clean about Asika's Chariot.
Oh, no.
Why you say, oh, no?
Confessions of a Magic Player.
Confessions of a Magic Player. This is perhaps the card that was maybe the most controversial in our set review podcast, because I know that Jet is very high on Asika's Chariot and thinks it's fabulous, and I was much colder on it. To be fair, not from a power level perspective. If you listen back, I think you'll hear that I wasn't like, this card is bad. I just thought it wouldn't fit the kind of gameplay that I wanted to encourage, and I was a little concerned about where the floor was on this card. And I gotta say, I've come around completely on it. I love this card. I don't think it's much more powerful than I expected, though I have maybe upgraded it a little bit in power level. But
so you're not really confessing anything?
No. What I'm confessing is maybe even worse, which is I'm saying that upon reflection, I actually think this is perfectly in line with all of my cube design principles, instead of being the opposite, which honestly is even worse than being bad at card evaluation. We're all bad at card evaluation, but I was bad at looking at a card and figuring out if I liked it. I mean, how hard is that supposed to be? So, I mean, just to recap, this is a 3 and a green for a 4/4 legendary artifact vehicle. When it enters the battlefield, you make 2/2/2 green cat creature tokens. When it attacks, you create a token that's a copy of target token you control, and it has crew 4. So the kind of like just on the card, you know, if you kind of read it and play it as you would expect, you cast it, it makes 2 cats. The next turn, you use those cats to crew the chariot, attack, and make a 3rd cat. And now you've gotten 6/6 worth of cats and a vehicle out of your 4-mana investment, which is a pretty good rate. Now, my criticisms of this card were that I felt like the vehicle, absent the cats, would be largely irrelevant. And so this was in the circumstance where you come up against an opponent with any kind of removal spell, even something as simple as a shock or a disfigure. This was basically going to be a Call the Cavalry, which is that, you know, 4-mana sorcery that makes 2/2/2s in white, which, fine, but not a card I'm excited to play in my own cube. Here's where I've come around on it. This is a snowballing threat, which is good if it's unanswered. I don't think in my cube there'll be many circumstances where it's unanswered completely, because I do have a lot of interaction. What I love about it, though, is that it is susceptible to pretty much any kind of interaction on some axis, right? You can cast a artifact removal spell to remove just the chariot. You can cast a small removal spell to remove one of the cats. You can cast a board wipe to kill both of the cats. But none of these things removes all of the value of the card. None of it takes it away completely. Even if you're left with just the chariot, there's a chance later on you could play a Sark in the Masterless and make a 4/4 dragon token and crew the chariot and attack and make another 4/4 dragon token. Like, that will happen sometimes, which I think is very cool. The other thing I was critical of it was that if you couldn't attack, this was, again, in a pretty bad spot where it was either a 4/4 or 2/2/2s, depending on how you wanted to block with it. And where I've come around to on that is that so many of Green's 4 and 5 mana threats are already incredible against aggro decks. Like, if you're playing aggro and your green opponent gets to 4 or 5 mana and they're not already at like 10 or less and you don't have a bunch of burn or, you know, removal in hand, it's gonna be pretty hard for you to win that game. I really like that this is a card that is not that great against aggro. It's, you know, it's going to be a call to Calvary against aggro a lot of the time, but actually that's okay because that's already a spot on the curve in my cube where I think aggro is not favored. And so this is going to slot right into my cube, and I'm very excited about it. I also did open a foil. Did that affect my evaluation? Maybe a little bit, because now I have a cool foil. That's, I've come around on this, so, you know, all credit to Jet. Not only is the card, I think, very powerful, but it actually does really conform with my cube design philosophy, even though I at first thought it did not.
So the really contentious part about this card, though, regular foil or showcase foil?
I am not... I mean, cats are fine. I would get the showcase foil if I had my druthers. I opened a regular pack foil, so I'll use that until the end of time, probably, because it's not going to be worth upgrading for me. I really like that showcase frame, and I don't particularly... I think it's... I get that people like it because it's like the illustration on the regular card looks like domestic house cats, probably looks like a lot of cats owned by a lot of Magic players. I have no affinity for that cat, though, so I would probably do the cool frame if it were up to me.
I'm going to come out and say I think those cats are cute.
Wow. Big, bold statement here. Anthony really planting his flag.
Somebody's got to be on that side.
Anything else for spring cleaning, Anthony?
You know what? There is one other thing. I am so excited by a huge change that is coming in Magic. I know it's been an exciting year. Not year. A couple weeks. Everybody's been talking about this big change.
It has explicitly not been an exciting year.
It has not been an exciting year.
This year has been a little extra, and I would like it to pop down and be a little less exciting.
But what is happening is they are finally removing the most horrible phrase from Magic the Gathering, converted mana cost, and I am delighted.
Yeah, I think that's a big improvement. They're switching the converted mana cost terminology to mana value, which arguably just as unintuitive as converted mana cost, but importantly, much more concise. And I think it's a good improvement.
I disagree. I think it is so much more intuitive. I remember vividly when I first started playing the game, this was one of the most confusing parts. Like, it made me think, like, this game feels sloppy and confusing and alienating when it's like, oh yeah, the converted mana cost. I'm like, well, converted to what? I literally had no idea what it meant. And if you put two cards in front of me and said, which one of these has mana value of 3, sure, it's a little bit vague, but I could suss out what mana value means pretty damn quickly. And converted mana cost is even worse because it just gets abbreviated to CMC everywhere, so even the word mana doesn't even get mentioned. I think this is a great change. I think it is bold and effective.
I am excited to do a little find replace on all of our articles on our website and just replace always instances of converted mana cost with mana value. That'll be very satisfying.
Now we just need one more thing from Wizards of the Coast to reprint every card that says converted mana cost in it that I want to put in my cube.
They can do it while they're also reprinting every single burn spell that could target players before 2018 or whenever they changed the Planeswalker damage redirection rule.
I think this is reasonable ask. Just make the cube format that has all of these.
Dude, I would totally buy Functional Errata, the sealed product. You know, it's just this is just like a secret layer, but it's got 670 cards in it, and it's every card that ever mentions converted mana cost or a target player that can deal damage to it.
Secret layer, the cards that do what they say they do.
I think I have a little opening bit for the show this week. Thank you, Anthony, for the inspiration.
No problem.
This has been Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you for tuning in. All of our music is made by DJ James Nasty. All of the Magic cards are made by Wizards of the Coast. All the listening is done by you. Thank you, Anthony, for talking about Magic with me.
Thanks for talking about Magic with me, Andy. Do you like mushroom pickles?
You know for a fact that I do.
Oh, man. I have a jar of these in my fridge. I'm going to put them on some ramen noodles with pork and cabbage and a pile of chili oil, and it's going to be delicious.
You're going to be sweating that one out.
All right, ready?
Give us the mushroom recipe.
All right, so you're going to start with 2 cups of dried shiitake mushrooms. You're going to soak them in hot water out of the kettle for about 30 minutes, just until you can slice them. While those are soaking, make yourself a little brine with 1/2 cup of soy sauce, 1/4 cup of sherry vinegar, 1/4 cup of white sugar, and, I don't know, 1 ounce or so of crushed ginger. So drain your mushrooms, and if you've not cooked with dried mushrooms before, there's a secret trick to it. You want to soak them, and then lift them out of the water so you're leaving behind any grit that's in the bottom.
Yeah, because it'll sink to the bottom. If you pour it out, then you're just going to pour all that grit all over your mushrooms again.
Exactly. So combine all of your brine ingredients, slice up your mushrooms. I like to do pretty thin slices, like 1/8 of an inch. Add them, simmer for about 30 minutes, and then after that, discard the ginger, put it in a jar. Did I say put also 1 cup of the soaking liquid in with the brine so you get all that extra mushroom flavor? And then just pack it in a jar, save it for a couple days, a couple months. I will not tell you the longest that I've forgotten a jar of these in the back of my fridge, and I survived eating them, but they're also good right away. The last thing I like to do if I'm feeling a little bit spicy is I really like it with a little bit of white pepper. So if you're into white pepper, try that.
And you should be into white pepper. It's good stuff.
It's contentious. Some people really don't like it.
Wait, really? I've never met somebody that really doesn't like it.
Oh, yeah. There's a big anti-white pepper contingent. It has this extra funky layer. It's worse than cilantro to some people. But I love it. I actually really love that funk.